front of Woodrow Wilson's White House, choosing prison rather than paying a modest fine. Others distanced themselves from Britain's Emmeline Pankhurst, ducking the specter of militancy and violence. What connected them was a sense of great social change. It was a time when a new century beckoned, and bohemian critics in Greenwich Village were challenging every institution from capitalism to marriage, experimenting with socialism, free love, art, and birth control. For women of the gilded set, modernity meant jettisoning old social customs, the cotillion and the costumed ball, the layers of clothing and rigidity of table settings, the decorous courtship and the marriage of strangers in favor of education, career, and independence. If they had remained on the sidelines, they would have become anachronisms. The fate of those who clung to their status as wives and daughters of America's most infamous capitalists, just as the Jazz Age was making celebrities of sports figures, musicians, and radio actors. Instead, they made a bid for influence, not the moral suasion of motherhood or the indirect power of social standing, but the political influence of the men of their class, long denied them because of their gender. Some contemporaries dismissed their participation as a fad, the indulgence of bored socialites trying on suffrage as they might the latest couture designs from Paris. Historians have echoed the critique, casting the activism of these gilded suffragists as a power play to preserve what one scholar called the prerogative of the elite to speak for the poor. What has been missing in suffrage history is an understanding that when women named Astor, Belmont, Harriman, McKay, Rockefeller, Tiffany, Vanderbilt, and Whitney exploited their social celebrity for political power, they galvanized interest among a growing urban public. In newspaper accounts of the day, their names were hidden behind the moniker of Mrs. Somebody Else. Excavating their identities and biographies was a work of archaeology. The sense of discovery bolstered as their numbers grew to more than 200. Researching their religious and political affiliations, their club memberships and civic causes, the source of their wealth, and the generation they were born into, all provided stunning examples of how a new century had shifted the ground beneath their feet. By 1920, more than a tenth of the gilded suffragists had divorced, quite a few had ridden bicycles or attended a university, and many had become published authors, bearing their souls in scandalous candor. Comfortable with the power that wealth conferred, these women treated politics as an extension of their realm as social figures. Accustomed to running large estates, they knew how to prod and when to delegate. Conditioned to press sensationalism, they knew how to manage the media. With large budgets and a taste for luxury, they also reveled in dressing the part. Katharine Houghton Hepburn was president of the Connecticut Women's Suffrage Association and an ally of birth control advocate Margaret Sanger. As her daughter, actress Katharine Hepburn, told biographer A. Scott Berg, "Mother's secret was in remaining extremely feminine. She dressed beautifully. She tended to her husband. She showed off her well-groomed children. And then, while she was pouring the mayor a second cup of tea, she would discuss with great intelligence some great injustice being heaped upon his female constituents. And then she'd smile and say, 'More sugar?'" The results of their intervention were consequential and instructive. From the celebrity capital of New York, they joined a cause that had been in the doldrums and made it seem intoxicating to a nationwide public. Newspaper coverage surged, attendance at suffrage events swelled, and the campaign gained ground. In their footprints, they also left a roadmap of how social change is made in America, sometimes by diffusing radical...